Hi, this is Ian Pickus. We're back in the Congressional Corner today with Vermont's at-large representative, Becca Ballant, a Democrat in office since 2023. Congresswoman Ballant, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
No, it's been since the end of February since we've spoken, so a lot has happened. And I want to start with the main thing, which is the domestic agenda bill that passed the House by just one vote, and you were a no vote, obviously. So what are your objections to that package?
This package is a betrayal not just of working people and middle class families across this country, but it's actually a betrayal of what Trump said that he was going to do when he came into office. He said he was going to make life more affordable for people. He was going to lower costs. And this bill goes after people's health care. It goes after food assistance for people. Nearly 14 million Americans are going to lose their health care because of the cuts that Republicans made. It makes the largest cut to food assistance in American history. And it's so shocking to me. I just came from a hearing, Ian, in which Republicans tried to deny that they cut Pell Grants to students. It's going to make higher ed more expensive for people. It is a betrayal of so many working families in order to give the very wealthy another tax break and increase our budget by trillions of dollars. It is, you know, it's interesting because in the last 24 hours, Elon Musk has actually come out against it and has said it's a horrible bill, which is an interesting turn of events. Yeah. It is a horrible bill. Absolutely. And it is not designed to help regular people.
Well, let me ask you this. There was obviously a full court press on the Republican Party. You know, President Trump went up to the Hill and they were calling individual members and trying to keep the different factions together. So you're there in Washington. And what have your conversations been like with folks on the other side of the aisle about how they were able ultimately to stay together as a conference?
Well, one tactic seemed to be not to share with the members what was actually in the bill. So you had even a significant number of Republicans in the last week saying, oh, well, I didn't know that the provision was in there that we were taking away a court's ability to enforce contempt charges. I didn't know that we were going to make it impossible for states to regulate AI. So the more they find out about the bill that they voted against, the more members are trying to run away from it. And so you asked me what were the conversations leading up to the vote. I want to be really clear with listeners. I was in a judiciary hearing for 8.5 hours in which Republicans literally said nothing about the bill. They wouldn't look at us. They wouldn't make eye contact with us. And this was played out over and over and over again in committees across Congress. They did not want to have to defend what was in there, so they wouldn't speak at all. And you can go onto C-SPAN and look at these hearings. And the other thing that happened, I was in a hearing in the middle of the night in the budget committee, and they were dealing with backroom deals that none of us had seen. None of us were on the Democratic side part of writing this bill. And then claiming, oh, no, there's no changes, even though in the midst of the hearing, people were saying, well, now that I've seen the changes, now I can get behind this. So there is a lot that happened in this process that was incredibly shady. But the bottom line is many of the things that are in this bill are not going to help regular people. And the more that Americans find out about what Republicans voted for, they're going to feel a sense of betrayal.
And I will pick that up in a minute. But in the meantime, I want to ask this question, because now you're in a reconciliation process with the Senate. And I've been asking members on this show if they expect substantial changes in the Senate version of the bill. Do you have any hopes that something different will emerge from the other House?
Oh, absolutely, because we already hear senators speaking out against it. You had Josh Hawley speaking out against the Medicaid cuts. Unlike his colleagues in the House who are not being honest about the Medicaid cuts, he's being really clear that there are Medicaid cuts and he doesn't support them. You have Rand Paul being incredibly outspoken about how Republicans are trying to deny that it increases the federal budget, and he's not having it. I think we're going to see more of this because the provisions in this bill are really unpopular. And every single poll that we've looked at shows American support for this bill, this reconciliation bill from the House, is underwater. It is not popular. People understand that it was not going to actually help them. And it is a bill designed to help the very wealthy who don't need a break.
So, you know, the state you represent, Vermont, obviously has its share of healthcare access challenges. So what will it mean for Vermont if these Medicaid changes are signed into law?
I'm very happy that you asked this because it is something that impacts rural America everywhere. It impacts rural hospitals throughout New York and more rural areas. It certainly impacts Vermont. Rural hospitals, if these Medicaid cuts go through, rural hospitals will close because Medicaid is the margin that keeps those hospitals open. And our healthcare system is very fragile, both nationally and in the state of Vermont. And you cannot take that much money out of the system supporting healthcare for people and not expect that it's going to have a negative impact. And in Vermont, 2/3 of the population are in some way supported by the Medicaid program. And so, yeah, you make those cuts, you're going after rural healthcare.
What do you think about the way that the tax cuts in the package were distributed? And you've been critical in our conversation, but, you know, the independent scorers who looked at it say they're, you know, overwhelmingly weighted to the top earners in the country as opposed to everybody else.
Yeah, you know, when you break it on down, is it really, can you really say to working people that a dollar a day is a significant tax break? No, you can't. It doesn't pass the straight face test. That is not a significant tax cut. And when you have people making over $1 million getting an additional $81,000 a year, it's sickening. We have the worst economic disparity in this country that we've had in over 100 years. And we should be designing a tax code that is weighted towards the lower and middle classes. They are the people that need the assistance right now. They're the ones that need reinvestments in their communities and their families. And that's not what we're seeing in this bill.
You think there will be consequences for the GOP, but on the other hand, you know, the midterms are 18 months away. So how do you see that playing out?
Well, first of all, I want to be really clear because, yes, of course, politics come into play. What I want people to understand is my party, Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, are working hard every day to make sure this bill never becomes law. And so that is the first thing, is that these cuts can't go through. The cuts to Pell Grants, the cuts to supports for the programs that regular working families rely on, they can't go through. And so that's what we're focused on. But we're not going to let voters forget who betrayed them and who was standing up for them and protecting their health care and their food assistance and veteran care and making sure that we're not cutting science and that, you know, we're not supporting this scam that was DOGE that has not delivered the savings for the government that they promised. And so it's critically important that we remind people that poor choices, poor governing has consequences. And I know a lot of people in this country who are right now in the same situation I'm in. I've got two high school students. I'm starting to look at colleges. It's critically important that we have Pell Grants for people. When you dismantle the Department of Education, those supports for working family to enable their kids to get an education go away. And it is a betrayal.
Are you going to let your kids go out of state for college?
It's interesting you say that, Ian. They have both said they want to go out of state for college, but we'll see. We'll see how it shakes out.
That's a tough one. I got to ask you about this rescission package that the administration has sent to Congress. And there is some self-interest in the question because it also includes, in addition to clawing back funding for programs like USAID, also the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NPR, and PBS. That's just been sent to Congress. What happens now?
It's not over. It's not over. Look, there is a lot in the rescission proposals that we've seen, and also in Trump's 2026 budget that he's putting forward, that what they are doing is play by play out of the authoritarian playbook. You go after education, you go after the news media, you go after resources that enable you to have an educated electorate, and it is about control. It is about trying to block the press from being able to report on what this administration is doing. And it's critically important that PBS and NPR stations across this country survive, because it is a check on the system. That's what the press is supposed to be. They're not supposed to be a rubber stamp on messages coming out of the White House. But what we've seen from this administration is their willingness to go after any entity that does not fall in line. The press is not supposed to fall in line. And so we will be absolutely pushing back on these cuts. And, you know, I was just in a hearing, too, going after universities. It is, again, it's almost cartoonish in the way that they are going after, creating enemies out of entities that are supposed to be dedicated to knowledge and learning and science. And it is so shocking to me that we have strayed so far away from our values. And we saw in the last 48 hours news breaking that there are federal workers now that have to essentially testify to their loyalty to Donald Trump before they can keep their job. This isn't supposed to happen in a country that values free speech and free thought. This is what happens in dictatorships. And I don't use that word lightly, but we've never seen anything like this before.
Is the rescission process legal? I mean, would that withstand a legal challenge? Because to my understanding, the funding has already been granted that the administration wants to claw back. I mean, it's been approved by the Congress, which controls the purse strings, right? I mean, it's for the existing budget year.
That's right. And so what we have seen this administration try to do through executive orders and now through the rescission process is engage in something called impoundment, which the Supreme Court has said the executive branch is not able to do, which is to take back money that has already been dedicated to programs that Congress has decided to fund. So it's going to end up in court. And that's what we are seeing, since January, that so many of the actions this administration has taken have ended up in court, and we continue to win. And what I mean by we, the American people continue to win time and time again, regardless of who appointed the judges. We've got Trump appointees, George W. Bush appointees, who are voting, you know, against what this administration is trying to do as it relates to taking away Congress's power of the purse.
So
it is illegal.
A couple of minutes ago, Congresswoman, you mentioned the word dictatorship. The thing I'm wondering is, how much do you weigh the fact that the return of Trump with all we knew about him with a Republican-controlled Congress was the will of the American people? I mean, there was very little mystery about, you know, how he would operate in a second term, right?
Oh, you know, Ian, I appreciate that question a lot. And it's something that I think about all the time. So a couple things. One, I think what we're hearing from a lot of voters right now is what they were voting for they hoped was an administration that was going to be really focused on the economy and lowering prices for them. They want to make sure that their kids, their family have a fair shot. What we are starting to see, and I certainly hear this from small business owners and from individuals across my district, even those who supported Trump, they will say, this is not what I was voting for. I was not voting for chaos with the tariff regime. I was not voting to not be able to make plans for my small businesses because on a whim, he tweets about something and the economic policy changes. And so, yes, on some level, you could make the case that people knew what they were getting. I think what has happened over the last 10 years is even a lot of his voters, they believe the things they want to believe about the good that they see that he's going to do for them, but they think he's exaggerating when it comes to things like rounding up a million immigrants and migrants. And what we've seen right now is that there are no checks now on the system because members of Congress who are supposed to be a check on the executive branch are not doing their due diligence. Republicans have continued to be a rubber stamp even as this president goes after habeas corpus protection, goes after due process. And so they're not standing up to it. But your point is a good one, Ian, in that I think Americans have forgotten how the democracy only works when we are fully involved in it. It's an idea that involves our participation. And it's messy and things don't happen quickly, but it's important that we as Democrats need to examine the ways in which we need to offer something better to the American people. And that starts with listening more to the struggles of working people and passing policies when we are in charge that benefit working people, not just in the long term, but also in the short term.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned your concerns about the way the administration is carrying out its immigration policies, and that has really come home to Vermont in a major way. I know you've got concerns about the Mohsen Mahdawi case specifically. Have you heard back from the DHS about that yet?
We did, and it was a completely and totally unsatisfactory answer. This is a quote from the letter. The information requested in your letter is currently the subject of active litigation. Accordingly, DHS declines to comment on such matters. DHS has a responsibility to answer to Congress. If they're going to use this provision that they're using, they have to make the case before Congress as to why this is appropriate. They're not doing that. And I'm very concerned with how Secretary Noem is conducting the Department of Homeland Security. There seems to be no guardrails. And, you know, when you look at these raids that are happening, we had a situation in Vermont last week where there was a raid on a construction site. And I am deeply concerned that these agents are showing up, not showing identification, with their faces covered. Again, this isn't supposed to happen in democracies. That's what happens in police states when people are not accountable to the American people. Whether you work for ICE or Department of Homeland Security, you work for the American people. And you have a responsibility to carry out your duty in a way that does not increase terror. You are supposed to be representing us, not furthering an authoritarian agenda. And so I am deeply concerned about due process rights for everyone who's living in Vermont. And it doesn't, you know, this is the piece. They're trying to rewrite the Constitution. And it says all those residents who live within the United States are entitled to these protections. If they will come for them, they will come for any of us. That's the case that I want to make.
I want to go to another area with you, and that is we often talk about Vermont's recovery from the storms of 2 years ago, and you know, now it's hurricane season again. Is the state ready?
I sure hope so, Ian. Look, this is on everyone's mind. I was actually this morning, I was talking with a rep who's a friend of mine, and she represents a district in Florida. And we were both talking about how deeply concerned we are to the cuts to the National Weather Service and also to FEMA. And when you have a new head of FEMA who says he's not even aware that there is a hurricane season, it's deeply concerning. That does not instill confidence that we are prepared for these terrible storms. And of course, as you know, hurricanes come up the coast. A lot of times as they come to us, what happens is we get inundated with water, and all that water flows downstream into all of our towns, villages, and cities in Vermont. And so any cuts to NOAA, any cuts to FEMA are going to have a negative impact on us. And I'm absolutely heartbroken for the people in North Carolina that had to withstand the kind of devastation that we encountered in Vermont. And for them, they're not going to get relief from FEMA. And it's deeply disturbing that this administration doesn't understand that we have a commitment. We have a commitment to people that when everything falls apart, we're going to be there. And I just, it's another example of turning our back on so many Americans. It's part of basic government services. So it's really important that people understand that it is important to have competent people. It is important to have people who actually know what their jobs are, who are ready to do the work and not fill government with partisans. You know, when you talk about the tens of thousands of workers, federal workers, nonpartisan federal workers who have been fired, that has a corrosive effect on government. And how are you going to get, whether it is help from someone at the IRS or at Veterans Affairs or at Social Security or Medicare, if you've cut the resources and there's nobody on the other end of the phone to help you get those services that you need and depend on?
So I want to wind up our conversation with a somewhat unusual question, but if you'll permit me, you know, we're speaking in Pride Month, and there are not a ton of out members in Congress. You're one of them. So I was getting ready to speak to you, and I was reading that the Pentagon is going to rename a bunch of Navy vessels that are currently named for civil rights figures, including Harvey Milk. And so this, you know, I don't think it's really possible to argue that the second Trump term has been about kind of minimizing, you know, what we know as traditionally underrepresented voices and figures from American civic life as part of this crackdown on diversity. So anyway, I mean, you think about things like, you know, taking names off forts or Jackie Robinson's webpage disappearing. Anyway, what's it like being a prominent member of the LGBTQ community in national politics right now?
Oh, look. They're coming after my community. And so I feel it most acutely. I feel that responsibility that I need to stand up for all of those folks across the country that don't get to be in those rooms that I get to be in. And they can bring forward their hate and their fear-mongering, and they can try to erase history, but we're not going away. We are part of every community. We are part of most families. And it is so short-sighted to believe that Americans are going to deny their own members of their family, their own flesh and blood, and that what we really want is to have Pete Hegseth going around renaming ships. What we want are supports to our veterans. What we want is to make sure that everyone in this country is entitled to rights. And you know, it is, I was just talking about this with my team earlier. You've got a situation, Harvey Milk, he served his country. not only in the Navy, but in elected office. The man was assassinated while serving his community. Those are the kind of people that I want to see whose names are on the sides of our ships, people who actually stood for something and stood up for other people. And so I will not be intimidated by this administration, because there are not just thousands of people, you know, if we just look in the Northeast, who rely on me to be their voice, whether they are part of the LGBTQ community or not, but we in America, we signal things to the world. And when we go after the LGBTQ community here in this country, we are signaling to autocrats and despots around the world to use violence and repression and discrimination against their people. I take that responsibility very seriously, and I am remaining fierce, but I'm not letting them get me down, because they will not. Doesn't matter how many names they scratch off of a ship, we're still here. We have served the country with dignity and distinction, and the pendulum's going to swing back the other way, and we will have long memories.
We've been speaking with Vermont Congresswoman Becca Ballant, an at-large Democrat in office since 2023. As ever, we're so grateful for all of your time, Congresswoman, and we're looking forward to the next one.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.